of human beings are go all over the place. You know, some people are smack dab in the tenth of a millimeter, and others are, you know, plus or minus 3 inches.
That's why engineering drawings are invented.
Yeah, but primarily for engineers. Yeah, Brian? No, I mean, I'm not an engineer. If I use those designs, no one would arrest me. Brian, you wanted to just check in, or you want to go on the list?
Both. A little late tonight, but I missed last week, so I'd like to do both, if possible.
Okay, consider yourself on the list. We have a bunch of people, so it might take a little while.
No worries. What is the subject tonight?
We don't have a subject. It's whatever people kind of bring up. Rich is discussing his magnetic loop and its present failure to tune past about a VISWA of 3-1.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I'll be listening when it's my turn. Thanks.
Okay, back to you, Rich.
The only variable to play around with, the only variable, is the length of these leads connecting to the loop. Now, some people have each side of the loop directly connected to the capacitor. I can't do that in my case because I'm making the loop out of 2-inch PVC wrapped in copper foil. So there's nothing else. I've changed coax 3 times. I tried 3 different coaxes, same results. So the only thing is the length of these leads, and it's going to be very hard to shorten them with this particular design, but as the TechNet goes on tonight, I am going to try to shorten them as much as I can. I guess I could take about 3 inches off of each one of the leads, and maybe with mag loops, that's massive. That's a massive length. It's the only thing I could think of. But I will be, I'll be listening and glad to answer Sam's questions about instant character recognition when it's his turn. Back to net.
Okay, very good, Rich. I mean, there's more than that makes a magnetic loop. A very important aspect is the coupler, where you feed the transmitter's power into, and that couples inductively to the large loop. The diameter of the loop, the location of the loop, if it's in plane, if it's slightly out of plane, it has a dramatic effect on the operation of a magnetic loop antenna.
Yeah, that I know. This is about my 4th build of a magnetic loop. I had this exact magnetic loop working fine. It was working wondrously. I worked all over the world with it. But this time I am not being able to get that VISWA down there. I'll work it out. I'll find out. I have a suspicion it's the length of the leads, because right now they're 6 inches, and that's a long run for connecting the capacitor. So that's probably it. I just have to do the work to make them shorter with eyelet connectors and whatever. I have to take them off. I have to solder them back on at a shorter length, and hopefully that shorter length will reach the bottom of the loop. So there's a bunch of things that I can try. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I wish you good luck, and hope you come back later and tell us you've had success. Again, if this unfortunately does not solve the problem, I would strongly suggest that you try to change around the small coil that's driving the mag loop There's a lot of different arrangements that can shift all kinds of things, including the Biswa. So keep it in mind if this particular branch of your solution fails to solve it for you.
No, I just sort of have a question.
Yes, Ed?
Have you been able to test the Biswa, SWR, at slightly changing the frequency to see if there is, it's just resonant at the wrong frequency, or is it pretty much across the board, 3.5 SWR?
The dips are across the board. No matter what frequency, the dips just go down to about 3.1 to 1, 3.2 to 1.
All right, never mind.
Yeah, I assume so. Rich has a nice VNA, and he has two nice VNAs, and he uses them, and yeah. Yeah, that would make things much easier if you could just, reset the resonance. But we'll see. I wish you luck, Rich, and I'm sure you'll figure it out.
By the way, with this particular problem, the Nano VNA is much easier to read than the Rig Expert VNA. I thought it would be the reverse. And I'm wondering if there's something a little wrong with the Rig Expert VNA, some type of calibration problem. But I'm using both of them now. That's how desperate I am to get this SWR lower.
Well, I mean, you follow the directions of calibrating the Rig Expert just the same way that you calibrate Nano VNA, right? You should always calibrate these VNAs before you take important measurements.
A Rig Expert says no, that coming the calibration done at the factory is sufficient. You don't need to recalibrate every time you change frequency span. The VNA, though, you do have to recalibrate every time you change the frequency span. So, but for some reason, Rig Expert says, no, you don't have to.
Well, you don't have to do anything. No one's going to write you a ticket. But didn't Rig Expert include calibration plugs?
No, it didn't.
Okay, it's different than my Rig Expert. They included calibration plugs, and I used them. In what way?
I think it's fundamental that if not for every reason, certainly if you change anything significant, you do a recalibration, which usually involves shorter plugs and open plugs. And keep in mind, the higher frequencies, when you say, I say shorted and open, it has to be at that frequency. There have to be any stray inductance or a passance or resistance floating around in those things.
Yeah, and also you... Yes, David, one second. Also, most VNAs recommend that you calibrate for 50 ohm nominal impedance as well. Yes, David, what do you want to say?
Magnetic loop antenna. This might be very obvious. To be very careful to check that it's constructed properly and set up properly, because one little mistake can throw you off.
So, okay, I mean, that's generally good advice for almost anything and everything.
Thank you, Roy.
Okay, I mean, yeah, it's up to you, Rich. You already have calibration plugs from your Nano VNA. It didn't cost you anything, and I don't think it would ruin the Rig Expert to go through the the calibration protocols. I know that nanoVNA seems to want you to do it, you know, every 3 seconds, but at least, you know, monthly. I wouldn't just kind of leave it and assume that the factors of electronics wouldn't cause the calibrations to drift over time.
That's a good question. Do you think I could use those little nanoVNA calibration plugs on the Rig Expert?
Yes, well, obviously with an adapter.
Right, of course. I just thought their size might, whenever I've looked at pictures of the plugs they use to calibrate the Rig Experts, they're much bigger than the nanoVNA calibration plugs.
The nanoVNA uses SMA connections, roughnesses
as
the Rig Expert
uses. Yeah, I need it.
Yeah, but an open, a precision open is a precision open. A precision short is a precision short. A precision 50 ohms is a precision 50 ohms. Size really doesn't matter as long as, you know, you match it with adapters, the proper adapters, as Roy said.
Yeah, I have the adapters that adapt from the SMA to 259, so I'll try it now that you guys are saying that it doesn't make a difference. I'll try to calibrate the Rig Expert with the nanoVNA plugs.
Yeah, I can't see where it's going to make the situation worse, and it'll probably make it a little bit better. I don't know if that's the solution to your problem with the Rig Expert, although, you know, mine is an earlier model. Other than the time that the power regulator blew out, I haven't had any problems with it.
Okay. I just don't understand why I'm not getting the amount of the dip on the Rig Expert than I am on the nanoVNA. But let me first see if the length of these leads from the capacitor to the mag loop change anything. If they do, I'll know I'm headed in the right direction.
Okay. I mean, you could have a mismatch in results because one of your VNAs is calibrated correctly and the other one's drifted over time. So it's possible that it's purely a matter of recalibrating it.
All right, will do. That's going to be interesting.
Yes, so I look forward to hearing the results. John, N2ZC, are you out there?
November 2, Zulu Charlie. You got me right.
Yes, I do. What can I do you for tonight?
Yeah, Roy, good evening and good evening to the net. I've been reading an antenna book, and one of the things in there seems to be they're talking about free space impedance of the dipole being 72 ohms, and he refers to this on and off without ever giving an explanation of it, which almost makes me think, does the dipole, so let's just say the coax would have 50 ohms, and the dipole itself would have a varying amount of input and impedance, you know, depending upon the height, etc. But is there such a thing or concept as, let's say everything is matched perfectly at, let's just say the coax is 72 ohms and the dipole is at 72 ohms. Is there a free space impedance, in other words, an impedance match between the dipole and free space and the atmosphere? Or is he just using that term, just loosely?
I have a question. What is your definition of free space in your application?
Well, yeah, now we're going to kind of talk about dictionary. My understanding is they're talking about pretty much outer space. They're talking about no particular ground anywhere within reason. So if you have a center-fed dipole between the Earth and the Moon, and you took out your rig expert, you would get a resonant impedance of about 72 ohms. As you bring it closer to Mother Earth, that impedance drops. So a practical center-fed dipole that any of us are going to put up, it's not going to be in outer space. It approaches more like a 50-ohm impedance than the original 72 in free space. So I use the term, I redefine free space as outer space. It may be less engineering technical, but most people know what outer space is, and most people don't quite know what free space is.
It is very engineering technical. Free space is infinite nothingness.
Yeah, well, we're back in the land of theoretical, and we got to kind of keep an eye on the practical and the real. So this is not an inherent quality of something called free space, but it's that theoretical construct of nothingness. Lots of luck going to find it, because outer space is depending upon how, again, you want to use the English language, the vacuum of space is full of all kinds of things. It's full of photons, it's full of neutrinos, it's full of... to a lesser extent, electrons and neutrons and protons, and not to mention the quantum fields that are embedded in it. So there's a lot of things going on in something we call a vacuum of space.
Can I state my usual heresy?
What about dark energy?
Well, that's for the graduate level course of technical met. We don't know what dark energy exactly is. We don't know exactly what dark matter is. It's still being pondered. But, Ed, yeah, sure, go ahead.
My heresy is, it's almost impossible to get an ideal incentive configuration. And if you don't have the ideal incentive configuration, your actual on-the-air performance only changes very, very little. And my comment is, don't sweat it. Just go with it. Just live with it. You'll never hear the difference.
Well, until you kind of go to the extreme end of it being not ideal. So, you know, I mean, sometimes it's interesting to kind of play theoretical, and sometimes it's very practical to play purely practical. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people sweat the details. You know, God forbid they have a system that has an SWR of 1.2. But if they figure out how much power they lose from that mismatch, it shouldn't keep you up more than a second, from a good night's sleep. So the problem has always sort of been, and I kind of mentioned it repeatedly, is we worry the details of things we can measure, and we're blissfully carefree about those other things that only military budgets can hope to test for, like the antenna's energy efficiency. You know, if people knew what their antenna's energy efficiency really was, they would really be angry.
KD2, WNA, comment.
Yes, what's your comment?
Yes, I was just wondering with the new comet out there, 3i Atlas, that just went past the sun and had a perihelion of the sun, and the sun had a lot of activity and a lot of solar spots and sunbursts and CMEs, Do you think we're going to see some more of that when it turns Earth-facing?
I would assume so, but, you know, you'd never know what the decay rate of those phenomena is like. So, you know, I would, you know, be on the watch for it. Not like we can do anything about it. You know, people have been talking about the disaster in the 1800s you know, these cosmic bursts that the sun fried all the telegraphy poles and such. So eventually, you know, we're going to get around to doing that to us. I hope it's centuries from now. But, yeah, it's possible. But, again, I don't think I'd lose any particular sleep because I can't think of anything that I could personally do to make a difference.
Yes, roger, roger. You're talking about the Carrington event?
Yeah, that's the big bugaboo. You know, every so often someone will bring it up and just look up at the sky. It only goes to show how powerless human beings are. And nature will out.
Yes, QSL, QSL. We are definitely at the mercy of Mother Nature, that's for sure. But thank you for coming back to my question. And I'll say 73s. I'm going to be standing by the side and listening. This is KDTWNA. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thanks for participating. So, John, where are we in your question?
Yeah, that's one of the things that's very frustrating with Echolink. You ask a question on the net, and then a whole bunch of people start getting in, and you can't get in, and your question is not even being addressed. So, back to that, I think you said that. My question was, you know, to be specific, again, you know, there's an impedance from the feed line to the dipole. Is there an impedance from the dipole to free space, atmosphere, outer space, whatever you want to call it? I believe you said no. And I believe what you said was that, you know, between, well, not even between, a certain distance from Earth where ground has no effect, the dipole has 72 ohm impedance. So I think you're saying that that impedance, that 70 ohm would be a matching impedance for a feed line. Is that what you're saying? It's not a matching impedance of the actual dipole to free space.
Well, it's the resultant impedance for a resident center-fed dipole in the environment of the vacuum of space. So, in other words, the interaction between the two dipoles and Earth when it's closer to the Earth changes its resultant impedance. So, you know, I don't know if you could really, you know, it's like discussing only one side of a coin. They have two sides, no matter what you do with it. So, I mean, it's not that it's the impedance of free space per se, but it's the resultant impedance of the interaction of the dipoles with the vacuum of space as opposed to something that has a ground potential within its near field or close far field type of phenomena. So I don't think you could specifically just call it the characteristic impedance of space itself. It's an interaction. If you change the antenna design, you can keep it in free space, but the resultant impedance could be completely different on them.
Okay, I'll give it one last shot. I don't think you get my question, but I'm not going to be like some people and just tie up the whole net on it. The question is, again, are you talking, when he is talking in this book of free space impedance, and when you are talking about it right now, you say, okay, if it's a certain amount of space from the Earth and, you know, it doesn't, if the Earth does not have an effect, it will have a natural impedance, we're just going to say it's 72 ohms, that's what he says. Is that the feed line impedance, where's the feed point, the feed point impedance? Or when we're talking about antennas, do antennas intrinsically have an impedance to radiate? In other words, it's a match. it's a match between the, I've heard some people refer to an antenna as a coupling device. A coupling device in free space or the atmosphere, you know, whatever you want to call it. So is that the, when they're referring to this impedance, free space impedance, is that the impedance of the coupling of the antenna to free space, or is we're talking back that it'll have a feed line impedance?
Okay, hopefully this is the answer to the question you're asking. The impedance at this point, assuming that there are no impedance transforming circuitry involved in the antenna system, should be the same impedance in the antenna. In other words, with a center-fed dipole in free space, as I mentioned before, at resonance, the inductive reactants and the capacitive reactants should cancel each other out, and all you should be left with is radiation resistance, and that radiation resistance is seen as the emission of energy off of the radiating antennas as it turns it into radio waves. So without impedance transformation passive circuits on the antenna's elements, it should be the same. The impedances at the antenna feed point should be the impedances for the entire radiating antenna, complete with radiation resistance, which is getting your RF out into the universe.
Okay, Roy, thank you, and I'll give it back to Ned.
Okay, thank you very much, John. Sam, you wanted to talk about Morse code.
Yes, Roy, thank you. Again, to me, Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf. I seem to have hit a glass ceiling. As Roy knows, I'm completing the beginner's class at the CW Academy and about to enter the intermediate class. But I'm looking to, proceed on my own. I can copy and write words at 10 words per minute with 80% accuracy with the ARRL CW practice tapes on the net. And hear letters at 13 words per minute. I can send very well. The copying is easy. But I'm stuck when it comes to getting past what I just described my level at. So I'm looking for ideas or suggestions to get me past, say, 10 words per minute. That's basically an outline of what's going on. Thank you, Roy.
WV2E is the answer for us, but let's see if anybody else jumps in.
Okay. Yeah, Rich.
Sam, the best tool that I've ever come across, and I have them all, to help instant character recognition is called Better ICR. Better ICR. Just Google that, and you'll come up with it. It was written by my former instructor in the intermediate class, and it's just great. The way it works is, it plays a character, a letter or a number, and you have to say it as fast as you can and then type it on the keyboard. And it gives you as long as you want to type it on the keyboard, but it measures how fast you can say the letter or number after it's sent. And it's just wondrous for increasing your speed. It was written by John Merkel, and it's open to anybody, and especially CW Academy students. Better ICR. Just Google it, and you'll find it on the web. It's not a program that you download. It's a web-based program, so you don't need to download anything. You don't need to install anything. You just use it on the web, Sam. Okay, do you got that?
Yes, I do, and I am definitely going to check it out. I thank you very much for your input.
My pleasure. I'm about to go into the advanced class. My problem is I learned CW with a pencil and a pad, and that's a no-no in today's world because they say you can't write very accurately past 20 words a minute, and I'm finding that, you know, to be true. So to move on from 20 to 25 to hopefully someday 30 words a minute, I'm going to have to put down the pencil and just do it all in my head. And instant character recognition goes a long way towards that. So good luck. Good luck with the intermediate course. And I was going to take the intermediate course over again because of my problem holding the pencil like a little comfy blanket. But Paul WS2N, who I sometimes have a sked with before the TechNet, and my instructor in the intermediate class told me, no, you'll waste your time. Go on to the advanced. So here I go, see what happens. It starts in January, and I'm very grateful to CW Academy to offer these classes. Back to net.
That is my experience, Roy.
Go ahead.
First of all, you may have it for 10 words a minute. The reason the general class Morse code exam back in the day was 13 words a minute was because everybody had a hump around 10, 12 words a minute, and they wanted to get over the hump to practice. Other thoughts. About having about a pencil, maybe for some people. Back in the day, I was a little more with it than I am now. I haven't found any low-brand CW very much lately, so I'm sloppy. But back in the day, when I did 25 words per minute, AWRL Home Practice Award, I did that with a pencil. The pencil was not any problem. I'm not saying I didn't have problems, but it wasn't the pencil. Another thing, now this works to me. First of all, above 30 words a minute, nobody uses a pencil. I knew some real old-timers who were excellent, 40 words a minute or so, and they didn't write anything down. They heard it like you're hearing me. It was almost like someone was talking to them. It was second nature. They didn't have to write it down and go back and see what they wrote. And I have found something interesting. What I've always done, I've always listened to the W1AW code practice ones over the air. I found them to be very, very helpful. And what I really found was good is they started the high-speed runs start at 35 words a minute and go down. And I would make a point of listening at 35 words a minute and be thrilled when we took one letter out of it. But I found it gave me a wholeness with it. It gave me a wholeness with more speeds that were way above my capabilities. Fast forward.
How to go on All Star with this repeater.
You know, Roy, we'll be back, and I am listening to all your comments because, you know, it seems that it's, you know, like, is it really real that you can achieve that instant character recognition in your brain? Is that a real phenomenon? Back to you guys.
There's an old joke. How do you get to Carnegie Hall?
Back practice, practice. It's absolutely right. And instant character recognition is achievable because my scores with better ICR keep on getting better and better and better. However, I've been pounding at it every day for the last 6 or 7 months, and there's no easy way around it. You just have to, like when you're learning how to drive a race car, they say you need seat time, S-E-A-T, seat time. And with Morse code, you also need seat time or ear time with no way around it. And you'll find out your ability to copy code will go up like a quarter of a word a month or something like that, or a half a word a month. But it does creep up. It really does.
Ed, I have a comment for you. NWS2M with advice on the CW.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, one of the good websites is from the ARRL, ARRL.org, code practice files. And you bring that up, and they have everything from 5 words a minute all the way up to 40 words a minute. And countless different things that you could listen to. You know, what I like about it is, let's say you're doing what, 10 words a minute. You go on that, and you know, you listen to it the best you can, and then right next to it, when you look at the file, you click on it, and it'll bring up the actual words. You know, so you can check to see. What you're doing. You know, you can go back and forth, and it's even fun to click on it and you bring up two web pages at the same time. You could be looking at the words and hearing the code at the same time. You know, that helps as well. But there's so many of them that, you know, I think it would take you years to go through them all. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
KG201.
Okay.
Comment.
Yes, David? David,
back
first.
Back in the old days, when you had to do CW to pass your test, it was a requirement. I remember, I don't know who told me this, maybe someone, you know, in the place where the testing was taking place, they said you can bring your own Keir device. And you can use it in the test.
Yeah, but that's not a big deal. The receiving is much harder than sending. Comment?
Yes, comment away.
Okay, Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf. Well, two things. I took my general down on Barrack Street at the FCC building. And what they did was they had headphones, and they sent you a copy, I guess, of 13 words per minute, and then they asked you questions. And fortunately, I copied back then, 1960s, just enough that I could make out some of the words, so I was able to guesstimate correctly the answers to the questions, but I really wasn't at 13 words per minute back then at all. My biggest problem having now is H and fives and S's. In other words, my ear is not discerning, you know, at speed, the minutiae of those type of letters and numbers. That's like one of the difficulties. So I'll copy down S's and H, and of course that throws you off. But that's the type of problem I'm having at 10 words per minute at this point. Back to you guys.
I think the sound in the ditch. I think I have to just go by feel.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I think you got to kind of take it more as music than it is anything else. And, you know, you can kind of tell something that's 5 beats versus 4 beats versus 3 beats if you tune your ear well. Now, you know, I'm sure there's a particular speed where people's ability to hear things kind of undermines that. But, you know, most people feel that, you know, learning Morse code should be more of a musical kind of experience versus any other kind.
I am having a good time doing it, and I'm enjoying the course. The CW Academy is excellent, and I am going to definitely check out the Better ICP program. So thanks for that suggestion, Rich.
You're welcome, and it's Better ICR, Instant Character Recognition. Better ICR. There's also Morse Code Ninja, which is the motherload of practice files, everything at every speed you could imagine. They send one word, or you could have them send two words, you could have them send three words, you could have them send five words. It's amazing, and at any speed from about 15 words a minute up to 45. Morse Code Ninja. Back to net.
Okay, very good. Anything left to be discussed here? If anyone has any further comments, please hit that push to talk.
Trivia comment.
Sure.
Back in the day, if you wanted to have license exam, you went down to the FCC office in Manhattan. I took my general exam at 641 Washington Street, but by the time I did my extra, they were up at 215 Barrett, or 210 Barrett. But the Morse code test, when I did it, was 5 minutes of test, and you had to get 1 minute of it perfect. So I believe in the late 70s, they changed it to they sent you a QSO and they asked you questions about it. But what I told them was 1 minute perfect copy of straight text. And that really blistered the paint off the walls.
Yeah, I could imagine.
The miracle is I survived it.
Well,
you guys.
Well, thankfully you did.
Helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome, Sam. Thank you for participating.
I have a question.
Hey, is it about this? Because you're right after David. I realize things are getting late, but we still have a half hour, so we should get to your question. But is it related to this question?
No, completely independent. Just something I wanted to go ahead and get some clarification on. When you're ready.
Okay, very good. Well, David, you're up next. Keep in mind, you got to leave a little time for Brian there. David, are you out there?
I go to the bathroom and let that.
Okay, I guess David had to step away for a little while. Brian, what's your question?
This is a little question that's been on my mind for a long time, and I just want to make sure I understand it, which I actually don't quite understand it. Long ago, you would have a RF gain control that was separate from your squelch. And, you know, everything made total sense. Now it's combined. Even though I have the squelch, it's combined RF squelch. And when I turn it all the way up, where it should be, I mean, everything is fine, but once I turn it down, the S meter pops up. So there's something there that I don't understand. There's a disconnect.
There's something I don't understand. Are we going for the ASAP to ASAP or ASAP?
Brian, do you want to answer Ed?
Sorry, I didn't hear his question.
He asked, is this
ASAP or PHF or what?
This is for either, this is for HF.
HF doesn't use a clutch.
Right, so why do they have a squelch on HF?
I never had one. What kind of a radio have you got?
I think, Brian, you might have a combined radio because I have something similar. The usual radio that I use for the Limark is a IC7100, which is an all-in-one. It has UHF, VHF, and it has HF. And it has the same type of squelch, which is set up for FM mode, but I don't think it works for single sideband. When I tried to get single sideband on Echolink, I discovered that Echolink is not designed for HF because you need to have a squelch, and a lot of radios don't have single sideband HF squelches. And the question you're asking is probably the first question that I gave to Dick many years ago when we had the mailbag, John was running it, and I emailed him that same question. Unfortunately, the way that a lot of radios hook up the S meter, the calibration is kind of crappy. The calibration changes according to what you set the RF gain for. So I think that's what you're alluding to.
Well, basically, you have a combined AF-RF/SQL control. So the AF is, of course, that's completely understandable. But the RF-SQL control, I mean, unless you're doing FM on the rig, and I don't mean VHF FM, it just gets a little confusing to me about how that works.
Should I, Roy?
Sure, Ed.
I trust is useless on HF. Plus works on FM. Because an FM, with no signal at all, is definitely raw. And you don't want that. Because what happens is, with FM, you use a tremendous amount of gain. And the background noise saturates your receiver. So it says close level. To say below this level, I will not put up with this abuse. And HF is meaningless. The only reason for RF gain was in the early days of single sideband, they found that you had to tweak the RF gain to optimize the decoding of single sideband. And that's really a primary reason for an RF gain control.
So basically, what you're trying to say is that it's vestigial.
I'm saying what you need. I have no idea what you have.
So I have, right now, I'm using a FT, well, not at the moment, but I have an FTDX10. But it's the same on my Yaesu FT710 as well. When you turn the RF gain control all the way up, you could see the signal strength pop and then come back down again, even though the RF gain is up. So when you reduce the RF gain, the signal strength increases. The incoming signal strength looks like it's increasing. I don't understand why. It's just like reverse logic.
S meters assume the RF gain is turned fully up. And if you turn it down, all bets are off.
So you're saying I mean, obviously you want it up all the way, correct?
As I said before, with single sideband, there are some times where things start to distort, and you might want to back off on it a little bit.
Right. No, that I can understand. But why does the signal peak up as you're lowering it down?
Because you don't have a linear system. It's all over the place. Estimators are designed for full RFN. If your RFN is not full, the estimator is basically just no longer right.
When I turn my RF gain clockwise, it comes up and it starts to peak the RF gain, and then as I turn it all the way to maximum, it actually decreases.
Are you using the estimator as your reference, or is there some other reason why you're saying it decreases?
No, I'm using the estimator on the rig as a reference.
And I am saying that's not the way it's meant to be used. If you can find some coherence, you're ahead of the game. But historically, estimator is intended on HF only, with full RF gain. If you turn it down, the estimator is not calibrated.
Okay, I think I'm beginning to understand, but I don't understand why it would pop up as I'm turning it clockwise and then reduce toward the end significantly.
You're assuming linearity. Linearity is a wonderful thing, but there's no guarantee you're going to get it.
Comment? Thinking
it's my understanding.
More clarity here. Thank you, Ed.
It's my understanding that there are different ways that you could measure the signal strength. And one of the least expensive, simplest circuits tie into the RF gain circuits. And so, unfortunately, if you're twiddling around with the RF gain, you're kind of losing any consistent calibration of the S meter.
Okay, so you're saying that the RF gain should be fully clockwise.
Unless you have some distortion.
Yeah, or it should be constant. It doesn't necessarily have to be maximum, but it should be consistent. If you start to move it around, you can't compare the S meter reading with one type of RF gain setting than with another RF gain setting. It loses its standard calibration completely. You can't even compare it because it's a moving target.
Oh, I have another reason for our thing. On 40 or 80 meters, you have atmospheric noise, which is like thunderstorms. And you might find that the RPN all the way up, the atmospherics are just deafening. So you might want to turn down the gain. But of course, you lose some signal too, but at least it saves your sanity.
Yeah, it depends on your front-end distortion level, how easily it distorts or not.
No, I'm just talking about a lot of atmospherics is hard on your ears.
Yeah, agreed.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
Thank you, Roy. This is Jim, KD2VHD. Short comment on RF gain control. I've found that on HF, it's a very good tool for bringing in weak signals. I found that any weak signal you're trying to pull in, if you twist back and forth on the AF gain and the RF gain, different signals will have a different spot where they come in the best. Completely variable. So if you want to measure on the S meter, maximum on the RF gain control. If you're trying to pull in a weak signal, twiddle those dials back and forth, and each signal will have a different max where you can hear it the best with either audio frequency amplification or RF amplification. I think it's an underutilized tool, the RF gain. Back to you, Roy.
A comment.
Okay, very good. Yeah, one second. We'll get to back to you in a minute. Again, it depends upon what kind of radio you're using. I think SDR radios have easier methods of getting signal strength and don't really get affected by the RF gain setting. My 6700 doesn't. I can fiddle with RF gain anytime I want, and I look at the pan adapter, and the signal strengths don't change. So it depends on the radio also. You know, I think if you have a pure HF radio, you usually don't have a squelch control. If you have a combo all-in-one, you do have a squelch control. But depending upon, you know, the engineering of the signal strength, it may be tied into the RF gain, in which you have to be aware of that, or it may have nothing to do with the RF gain, which makes life a little bit easier. Brian, you want to say something? Yeah, Brian.
Says in the FTDX10 manual, RF default setting, the RF gain control provides manual adjustment of the gain levels for the receiver RF and IF stages to account for noise and signal strength conditions. RF SQL knob is normally left in the fully clockwise position. So, yeah, I get that. I get that. But I'm just curious to know, when you lower it down, how come the signal strength goes even higher? That to me is what I'm asking.
Well, I would say because they tied the signal strength detection into the RF gain circuitry as a means of saving a couple of bucks.
Okay, good enough.
You know, and in line with the software-defined radios, most of them that are full SDRs don't have IF stages.
Most of hybrid.
Yeah, hybrids, if they can kind of digitize it past the IF stage, and so they're a hybrid. But, you know, the full SDR, and I think the radios of the future, are going to be digitized from the front end of the receiver's, you know, initial RF amplifier.
Well, that makes complete sense.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point is go away from, you know, amplifier stages and all kinds of things, digitize it as soon as you can, and then process the data like any other computer does.
Understood. Okay, thank you.
Comment?
Certainly, Sam.
Well, I just got a new transceiver, the FTDX101MP, and it has like a superhead receiver before it goes into the SDR. Their philosophy is that they will try to clean the signal before it goes into all the SDR functioning, and therefore you have you're able to play with a better signal as a result of that configuration. I think I'm pretty accurate in that statement. That's the end of my comment.
Let me do another comment on his comment.
Certainly.
The main point of using SDR is to have proper audio filtering characteristics. SDR can give you audio filtering that is completely unavailable with analog design. Back in the day, you would have like crystal filters with selected bandwidth, switch selectable, and you have no control over what's called the search selectivity, just the set of frequencies. Now you can adjust the search as well as the set of frequencies. The search being defined as not how wide it is, but how steeply does it fall off once you get out of band. It's the software that gives you that. So the rest of it is kind of optional, where you change over to digital.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to be said for being able to do all of the stages of a legacy radio in computer. When I first got my 6700, it couldn't...